And we're live with our 309th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. Always happy to be here. Kicking off 2026. I mean, we did last week, but we have Nathan joining us today. And we'll be digging into his background, what he's doing over at Vonta, and all things, you know, security related from his career here shortly. Before I get into that, I did want to give an update on, training. Let me grab it. I'm trying to get it here. AbsoluteAppSec.com. I have updated the available trainings that Ken and I will be running. Across the board, right? So we're going to be at KernelCon doing harnessing LLMs. We'll be at Black Hat Asia teaching next gen AppSec and secure code review, which is the Black Hat edition of all the things. And then we will also be at DEF CON Singapore. So opportunities are out there for people to sign up. If you are looking to take your AI usage to the next level and not just utilizing the chat windows, this is your opportunity to do that. Ken and I are gaining more and more experience along those lines on a daily basis, trying to make LLMs do what we want them to do. So that's it. That's where we're at. Outside of that, I think both of us will be at B-Side San Francisco and at RSA. Dry Run and Redpoint are going to be hosting a happy hour. And, you know, Nathan, if you're going to be out there too, I'd love to have you, you know, come along. I know RSA is a, you know, yes, it's not, and not everyone's favorite conference to go to, but it is a necessary evil, I want to say at this point. But yeah. But with that, Ken, anything else we should announce before we, you know, introduce Nathan?
Okay. No, not that I can think of.
Okay. Well, Nathan Hunstad, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Happy to have you.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah. And I'm trying to remember, like, we started having discussions, I think, in November or December to have you on the show, or it might have even been earlier than that.
I think it was earlier than that. Yeah, I think we've been chatting for several months now about appearing. And yeah, happy we were finally able to make it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had seen Nathan on a podcast, and I was like, oh, I'd love to have him as a guest. Obviously, I'm a fan of Vanta. Is it Vanta or Vonta? Or?
It's Vanta.
Vanta.
Okay.
Yes.
Because I never know how to say it. But I'm a big fan and I don't know how to pronounce the name, but no, I really do like the product. I really do like the team, and I like, I pretty much like, love everything I see coming out of it. So anyways, thought it'd be nice to have you on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before we get into Vanta, right? Though too much, because I know the platform, like we would probably like a rundown on everything that you're doing over there. But let's talk a little bit about your history, right? Like, you know, start with an introduction of what you're doing at Vanta as far as like what your position is. But then let's go back on your origin story, like how you got into security, how you got to where you're at.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am the director of security here at Vanta. And I lead our security engineering and security operations teams. I've been at Vanta for almost 2 years now. In terms of my history, I've been doing security for almost 15 years now. It's been a while. Before that, I was actually in IT. So I was kind of like the IT guy, help desk, did some app development where necessary, did some network stuff. And I'd always been interested in security, but I really didn't know how to break in to the security industry. And I had looked into things like network security, which I really wasn't interested in. Like, I didn't want to get like Cisco certified and configure firewalls to do that kind of stuff. I wanted to do security from more of like a governance and policy kind of perspective. And at least at the time, there just wasn't any like obvious way to get into that. And then kind of like fortunately, and this was like just perfect timing for me career-wise, the University of Minnesota created a brand new Masters of Security and or Masters of Science and Security Technologies program in their Technological Leadership Institute. And that was exactly what I was looking for in terms of like an education program for security. So I was part of the first cohort to go through that. It was a fantastic experience. There were about 30-ish people in the cohort. And after we graduated, I started working along with several of my classmates at Target on their security team. So I worked there for several years. I was at Target during their famous breach that happened now over a decade ago. So that was absolutely a big learning experience for me. Worked at Best Buy for a little bit, then moved to Code 42, where I was there for over 7 years in various roles. And then after a brief stint at Albertsons, I'm here at Vanta.
So you kind of went the internal defense, offense sort of route, then back to defense. Is that sort of right or no?
Yeah, kind of right. I have been mainly focused on defense, although I've had some red teaming capabilities on my team at both Code 42 and here at Vanta. But I've been primarily focused on defense, and that's what I really like doing. I like finding the bad guys and figuring out what they're up to and stopping them.
Did you work with Ty Spano at all at Target? I feel like he was there for a while.
Yeah, the name, I recognize the name, but I don't know if our paths ever crossed.
Well, I remember working with, here's one thing, sorry, this is also like, speaking of the past and whatnot, you mentioned Best Buy. I remember being at Living Social and, you know, I've managed the security team. I remember Best Buy's offensive team doing a like, kind of a assessment of their vendors, you know, they're doing partnerships with. And man, they did a great job on pen testing our website. I had some serious cleanup to do. I was very, very for the record, circa, like you said, a little over a decade ago, Best Buy's team was on point, man. It was really, really impressive.
Yeah, there were some sharp people over there, absolutely.
What drew you to the policy side of things? You know, because I find it fascinating. I really do. Like, spend a lot of time with one of our internal folks who basically it's a lot of compliance and policy and making sure we're doing the things we're supposed to do. And I actually find it very, very fascinating. But you don't hear a lot of people, I feel like, say that out loud. And so I'm curious, what draws you to, you know, what kind of drew you to this field?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good question. And I think that ties to my background even earlier before I got into security, which was, you know, in college, I was a political science major, not like tech oriented at all. And then my first real job after college and was working at the Minnesota State Legislature, and I was there for 11 years. And so very interested in policy. I did not start in technology then. I was more of like a writer. And very interested in policy, very interested in the like legal side of things. And I think I just carried that over into security because I do think that with all of the, you know, fantastic technology that's out there, all the tools and all the capabilities, that's fantastic. But if you don't have a solid foundation of policies and governance to use them within, then it's just like having a bunch of instruments in an orchestra without a conductor. Because at the end of the day, all those tools have to support some kind of goal. And those goals are typically defined in your policies.
I mean, that's an interesting path, Nathan. Like, I don't see a lot. Like, this is one of the things that we find fascinating on the podcast specifically is the background of people as they get into security, because no one lives in a silo, right? And so, like coming from a political science background, like I start to think like selfishly, like that's one of the things that my daughter did in school as well. And she's been doing like policy work, and she's getting into like AI policy now as well. Absolutely. Because it's kind of this collision of, okay, what her dad does versus what she's been studying in school. And it makes for very interesting kind of crossover between worlds. Along those lines though, right? Like I feel like policy in general drives a lot of, as a third party, a lot of my business in general, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that we have things like PCI, that we have government regulations, like whether that's EU or US regulations or state regulations, like we come in as a third party to actually validate what is going on and whether or not these applications adhere to policy.
Yeah.
So I would be interested to know, like in your experience, like in that world, how do I phrase this? Like how technical or what experts are like the people creating the policy actually leaning on in mm-hmm. order to make sure that it aligns with what is what the capabilities are and what the security risks actually are.
Yeah.
I know that's a loaded question.
Yeah. But, yeah. I mean, it is, but it is really important because I think there's been lots of examples of policies that have not brought in the proper like technical expertise, and they have been unrealistic or just hard to understand. And that's why I think that it's really important to have strong people on the policy side, not only internally, but also externally, to make sure that if you are crafting a policy for your own organization, for your employees to consume, or if you're crafting like, you know, AI policy and security policy for a government or legislation, you need to make it understandable and you need to make it realistic, because people will always find ways around it if they find it too hard to understand, if it's just too onerous. And that's not the goal at the end of the day. We want to improve security. We want to have the right guardrails in place, but they can't be arbitrary and they can't make people's lives too difficult.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And that was one thing that I did want to highlight, because Vanta in general is focused on organizational policy, right?
Yes. Like
not
exactly.
Governmental policy.
Exactly. Right? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so it's a tool that an organization can use to help flesh out those policies, mm-hmm. build them, right? Like there's a library, or actually meet compliance regulations, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes, absolutely. So Vanta can help you both come up with the policies as well as implement the controls and tests to make sure that those policies are actually being followed and are effective.
Okay. That's an interesting space to play in. Just because there is such a need across the board. How involved do you get with like customer requests and actually building the policies in those cases?
Yeah, so my team does not get involved with that, but we do have another team internal to the security team that does help out with customers when they have special policy needs or control needs, control mapping, those kinds of things. So yeah, the security team as a whole is involved in those kinds of activities.
Okay.
I want to throw this out there too, because I know it's a little off track, but I was thinking about how you were mentioning the importance of policies, and then Seth had mentioned like AI bits, and we all know that AI is changing the shape of things. But as I was thinking about that, I realized like you're right that policies are even more important now, I think, because you're able to spin up infrastructure very easily. So uh-huh. like for instance, if you want to go and put some infrastructure online, if you have AWS tools installed, GitHub tools, using Claude or Codex or something, you can literally just tell them like, hey, spin me up a server, and nothing would be managed by Terraform unless you tell it to do that.
Yep.
Nothing would be managed by some sort of infrastructure as code, but you could put that online very quickly, and that would be a bit of a mess, right? You can create and ship new things like overnight now, right? That would have taken months and whatever. I guess my whole point is that whether it's spinning up infrastructure, pushing out new changes, making whatever kind of, basically you have the capability of doing pretty much everything instantaneously. And I foresee a world in which that just, that builds and builds and builds, and without a good, you kind of, I don't remember exactly what you said, but you said something along the lines of it being something you kind of anchor yourself to mm-hmm. do things correctly. And I actually do think that's going to be very, very important. But I'm curious, is like, is your security team at, I don't know if you know, if they, that works with customers, if they're feeling that, or are you hearing that internally? Like there's a shift with just the speed of, and velocity of things that, yeah, I don't know if this is impacting you all.
No, absolutely. And that does affect my team because my team helps our Vanta engineering team develop securely. And the velocity with which our engineers, as well as, you know, like you said, pretty much any engineering team or just somebody who wants to vibe code, the velocity that they can put something out there is just amazing these days. Personally, I've been using AI to actually terraformize and put all of my home infrastructure in Ansible. I did that recently. It's been fantastic for things like that. And you can do a lot with these code AI code agents now. But as you said, you know, the fact that you can do it so quickly also brings some risk. So I think that you also need to leverage the speed and velocity of AI for detections and technical controls, because it's just as easy to spin up a check to make sure that you are encrypting all of your EBS volumes in AWS as you're spinning them up using AI. And you can also use AI to generate the policies that are appropriate for your organization, their tech stack, and level of risk, which is something that we use internally to make sure that our policies are aligned. So AI is the, you know, a potential risk increaser, but if you use it properly, it can also decrease your risk as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, automatically map changes to policy documents.
Exactly.
Any releases process could immediately be audited for following that whatever, if it's release process, policy, change management, data classification, sensitive data, whatever it might be, like that's pretty interesting. Also, one thing that you just mentioned was that you guys are helping folks with that. I'm curious, like are you able to sort of optimize, like help people get to a good baseline and then stay on a good baseline?
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, that is one of the core things that Vanta does in terms of being able with our automated tests to identify what the good baseline is, you know, when it comes to AIM or IAM, sorry, making sure that you have MFA on all of your accounts, you know, those kinds of things. So they help you get to that baseline. And then if something drifts, if something goes awry, then those tests will automatically flag the owner and say, hey, there's something that needs to be addressed here. We use Vanta internally for our own compliance and GRC needs. And so I am a Vanta test owner and control owner. So I sometimes get those alerts that say, hey, check this out. There's something that you need to look here from a security perspective. And it's very useful for keeping on top of those kinds of issues.
And I have a question as a startup, I'm curious, like when you see people, like how do you recommend, like let's say your startup, you know, you're going to at least have SOC 2 required soon. I mean, pretty much every product requires that. How do you, like, what is sort of the best way to kind of get started? Do you, I'm kind of curious, like, I could tell you how we did it, which was, I felt painful, which was to like go down the road and then have somebody say, hey, you got to be a grown up, right? And do compliance. And then like back, overhaul for whatever things you hadn't thought of already, because it's, you know, it's, you get funded, you're ready to uh-huh. go with your idea, you start building, and then yeah, you kind of like just build, because that's the priority. And then it's like, oh, there's the SOC 2 thing. And I'm just curious, it's got to be a less frictionful way, I guess, or a frictionless way to do that.
Yeah. I mean, that is what one of the goals of Vanta is to like just reduce the friction. Because when you configure Vanta, you hook it up to integrations, it will start pulling the data that will at least tell you where you are. And identify any gaps that you have to getting your SOC 2 or whatever compliance framework you're after. So I think that is probably, you know, a tool like Vanta is the easiest way to do it. You know, as you said, when you are a startup and you're just one or two employees, you're not thinking about security. You're really just making sure that your company is going to exist in, you know, in a month or in a quarter. And I don't think it is realistic for people to start off thinking securely. I would say that to the extent that as you're making architectural decisions, you can choose the secure path whenever possible, it'll make your life easier down the road. But unless you have somebody who knows security to help you identify what that secure path is, it's also not always possible. So I do think the most typical situation we get in is that you've got a startup, they've been told by a major potential customer, hey, you need to get your SOC 2. Having a tool like Vanta that's there, that has the controls in place, that has the tests in place, that can at least identify the gaps and point you in the right direction, is probably as frictionless as it's going to get.
Yeah. I mean, I had some advice once from somebody who had been through the process multiple times, and basically exactly what you're saying, Nathan, right? Like, hey, you know, do things securely, mm-hmm. like be smart about it as you're building, at least think about security. But the other recommendation is wait until it's required.
Yes. Right?
There's a lot of startups that are out there that'll jump straight into, hey, we have to be SOC 2 type 2 compliant. And you're like, why? Right. Mm-hmm. Like, do you have a big customer that's asking you for that? Is there specific like details that you're running with? Because there is, like, once you jump on that bandwagon or you're on that train, you can't get off.
Yes. Right.
SOC 2 requires the yearly, it requires the updates, you're going to be mm-hmm. paying for it. It's not a single use type certification. So that's been the other recommendation, is people come to me and they're like, yeah, we're two people, like we need to get our SOC 2. And I'm like, no, you really don't, right? Like, there's a lot more to worry about.
Yes.
Like, think about it eventually, but wait until you absolutely have to.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. And again, I think the important thing is that you can make decisions early on that can make it easier when you do find that you need to do it. Like, don't write all your admin passwords down on a piece of paper or a post-it note. Like, get a password manager from the start. Get a good IAM tool from the start. If you do those kinds of things, then you're going to be way ahead of the game when it comes time to actually get your SOC 2.
Yeah, it does feel like adding single sign-on so mm-hmm. that all your most services that you log into have, you know, single sign-on available. Then I would say, like, on that note, access, keeping control or keeping track of who has access to what and reviewing mm-hmm. that access.
Yep.
Then let's see, what's the other really, really important one would be having a change management tool in your pipeline. Managing infrastructure with code so that it's managed that way is really, really helpful. And then I think the last thing I would say that was really helpful for us was utilizing a shared responsibility model. If you can do that with a, you know, I know some people have to host whatever in their own slot inside of a colo or a data center. But for those of us that can use AWS or Google Cloud or Azure or whatever, you've got their the shared responsibility model, and that helps defer a lot of those questions. And I feel like if you do those things in the very beginning, also one mistake that we made, and I don't know how you see this a lot, but one mistake we made was we have a really awesome guy, and he had unfortunately been the one who got through SolarWinds for compliance after the breach. Yeah. And so we kind of, maybe both of us were a little gun shy and a little nervous. And so we over-engineered and ended up creating way more policies and way more things than we actually needed. So my, I don't know if you see this a lot, but I would say make sure that you reach out to your experts with whatever service you're using. We didn't go with Vanta our first time around. You know, you guys are a little expensive, so we had to go somewhere cheaper. I really wanted Vanta, to be clear, but you know, we had to go a little cheaper route. In any case, I think if we had just talked to them a little bit earlier, we could have saved ourselves a bunch of time on that end of things. Does that happen a lot? Do people over engineer or are they under
I think it probably doesn't happen a lot at the startup level, but I've absolutely seen, especially as organizations have some success and have some growth, they may move towards over-engineering things. And I do think that does get in the way. And to kind of tie it back to our earlier conversations about, you know, policies and governance, the thing that has to be your guiding North Star is your organization's risk posture and the amount of risk they're willing to tolerate, as well as just understanding what those key risks are. I mean, to your earlier point, for a lot of startups, the biggest risk isn't something like SolarWinds. It's not something like ransomware. It's the fact that they're not going to be able to get the customers they need to survive. That needs to be the primary focus until these other risks become relatively more important. And for a lot of companies, they may not need to get, they may never get to the point where they have to think about a SolarWinds kind of infrastructure or attack, simply because they're not going to be an attractive target or they don't have that kind of deployment model. So it's also very important to make sure that you are paying very close attention to your risks and having a realistic assessment of what they are, because it's very reasonable to say, no, I don't need to do this complicated stuff. It's not worth the ROI. It's just going to make things harder to support. And that's not a realistic thing we need to deal with anyway.
So what you're saying is exactly the conversation that I have with organizations probably every other week, right? Like as a service provider and as a tester, I can't tell you the number of times I've been asked, well, where's your SOC 2 type 2 cert, right? And I'm like, why, right? Like, why are you asking me this question, right? Like, this is what we do. This is the service we provide. And, you know, there's a little bit of data and like, we have an information security policy, like we do things. And I've had to hold back because at times it does feel like I have to over engineer my policies to meet the questions that are coming from other organizations.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that nuance that you're talking about there is there's a lot of gray area.
Yes.
And, you know, as a small provider, it's hard at times to be like, no, you really don't need this, right? Like when it is a Fortune 10 company that's asking, right? Like for whatever, like sort of logs from the past 3 years of all the access that we have, right? like that sort of thing, then I'm like, guys, we don't even have an internal network, right?
Right.
Like this is the wrong question to be asking.
Yes.
Now, you know, to be fair, there are like, I'm sure with Vanta and other places, like they take that into consideration on questions that are being asked, but it's hard with some of these older compliance organizations to make them understand because they just don't deal with companies like our size very often.
Yeah. I mean, that also gets into the whole other topic of just third-party risk management and how hard it is to do that in a scalable way. And what a lot of larger organizations kind of fall back to are the, you know, it's the old fashioned, I'm going to send 300 questions, 500 questions in an Excel spreadsheet, and I want you to answer them. And if I don't like your answers, I'm going to come back and ask some follow-ups. Yeah. And I mean, to me, that itself is also not particularly effective when it comes to addressing the true risk. And, you know, to your point, what is the risk to an organization if they're using a vendor like you? Probably not nearly as comparable to their payment vendor. And so why would you use the same approach when you're evaluating them?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, when the hammer is the only tool that you have,
that's the
one exactly. that gets used, right? Like that's the old anecdote. But because I struggle with this question, right, on mm-hmm. a daily basis. Like, how do we respond to these? Because, for us as a small business, we want to win that business, right? We want to be able to sign that contract, provide that service. And so I'm constantly looking at, okay, how much can we spend to meet these compliance needs, right, from mm-hmm. a time, manpower, or even, like, service perspective versus what's actually going to come in from that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Like, absolutely. You know,
I mean, you know, Ken, are you running into similar things? I mean, as a, you know, SaaS platform, I think you've got other, other outstanding needs, right?
Actually, you know, my needs back to the business point of like being able to get work in to close sales. That's actually one of my bigger priorities. And to that end, one of the things, and I got to say, it wasn't just Vantu did this. Our provider that we use also did this. And I love that you all as in the category of product are doing this, which is security questionnaires, man. That is the thing that I and every other CTO or engineering leader hate. Like they just, they're so, sometimes it, for a myriad of reasons, we just all agree that they're a huge pain. I understand I guess I could spin off into a whole thing on, I think it was Frankly Speaking who had Frankly Speaking's Substack who had like an article about this where it was sort of, you know, what are you trying to actually get out of your vendor? Why are you throwing the gauntlet of 150 questions at them? Maybe you should be looking at what they're providing for you and mm-hmm. ask only the questions that matter the most for that. But we're not there yet. Where we are though, however, or at least I don't think we're there yet. But where we are, I know, is we're at a point where I can upload a questionnaire and then your system and other systems now can leverage my pre-written policies to those questions. And my God, even if you get, and I got to tell you, even if it's like 50% filled out or even 35% filled out, I don't care. Like that's a huge, huge leap forward. And I want to say that out loud. That's one of my bigger challenges is getting through those quickly enough like help sales continue down the pipeline to lock down those sales.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're a software provider. We get those questionnaires all the time. And so we have in the Vanta product, a feature called questionnaire automation that does what you just said. So it uses AI to look at your policies, look at the answers you've provided in the past to your questionnaires that are the same, and really tries to automate generating the answers that are accurate as much as possible. And that has really made life easier for our customer questionnaire team because we get them frequently. Could be in any format. And we want to turn it around the salespeople are saying, hey, I need this today. We want to enable the business to sell. And it's been a game changer.
Yeah. And the questionnaires themselves have gotten, you said they could come in any format. And it's like, that's become a thing too, is people are making their own sort of AI questionnaires. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I can't actually comment on if there's a good standard that people could be using for those questionnaires. Maybe you could, I can't, but I will say I see like every flavor of the sun of people trying to kind of guess what's an important, and it's so funny because the needle moves so quickly too, that's like maybe those questions were relevant 3 months ago, but they may not be relevant today. They may change the way that things are working.
Yes.
I don't know. I don't have much there to offer other than like, I wish there was a more unified sort of AI questionnaire approach. And I think the only one I've heard of, and it's not really AI centric. It's like CAIQ.
Oh yeah. The cake. Mm-hmm.
People are trying to sort of use that, but I don't know. Have you seen anything useful in the AI questionnaire checklist space yet?
Personally, I have not. I don't read a whole lot of questionnaires, so I'm not as familiar. But yeah, I'm with you. I think there's a lot of different approaches that people are trying to take right now, but the space is moving so quickly, it is hard to even standardize on a set of like, here are the AI security things I need to care about.
Well, and how often, you know, speaking of changes, how often did things change in your world standards wise? Like, you know, I mean, are there fairly, I don't, because, you know, when you talk about compliance, you know, you're talking about many different frameworks. Mm-hmm. For you, what's the velocity of those things changing and how difficult or how easy is it to stay apprised of, you know, what's the diff of requirements from one iteration to the, mm-hmm. the next, and then advising, you know, clients on what they need to do to make sure they're still compliant.
Yeah. I would say that the frameworks don't change all that frequently. So there's not a lot of need to keep on top of those changes on a constant basis. It's more, I think, of a case that customers are expanding into other frameworks. So they may just be operating in the US and they want to start selling to Europe. And so GDPR becomes a thing that's on their radar. And that's just like a big pile of things that they need to worry about. Or they're looking to get some AI governance proof that because their customers are asking for it. So they've decided to like do ISO 42,000 around AI. So I think it's more an issue of like expansion versus having to keep up to date with the frameworks changing themselves, because that doesn't happen too frequently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's sort of like, I've already got SOC 2. Someone told me I need to go get ISO 27001.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. Whatever. Mm-hmm. And now I need to figure out, do you ever see policies contradict each other between those two standards?
I don't know if I've ever seen them contradict each other, but they are sometimes different enough that it becomes hard to kind of unify them. I think everyone wants a unified control set so mm-hmm. that they can map a simple set of controls to SOC 2, to ISO, you know, to HIPAA, to PCI. And that's, at least in my experience, that's been challenging, especially as you add on the number of frameworks to the list, because there's just nuance between those different frameworks. They don't match up perfectly. So it's less of an issue of like directly contradicting them each other, but one may say something about a password length or complexity that is slightly different from another framework. So how do you mesh those two together in a way that makes sense?
I don't know about you, but password complexity, and I'm Seth, I'm curious on this one. That is, to be frank, it's the most annoying part. It might be one of the most annoying things to have to bring up to someone in any, like whether it's your line or whether it's your niche or whether it's Seth and I's niche of just AppSec. I feel like that is the most annoying one because everybody's got opinions. It's just like you could go back and forth for days on that. It's just like, I don't know, man, try to do a good job, like stay within these reasonable bounds. Like when you get too prescriptive, it gets to be like a debate. And yeah, anyway, Seth, Seth, I know you've dealt with this. So like you tell me a little bit about your thoughts here.
Well, and okay. So to Nathan's point, this is where actually like updating of some of these frameworks and standards would be helpful, right? You know, mm-hmm. I know they do over time, but some of the risks that were associated with that, and especially since SOC ties back to organizational policies, that's where we run into these sort of, hey, you have to change your password every month.
Yes.
Right? Where it hasn't updated to this research of actually, when we make requirements like that, the passwords become more insecure because yes. users are tend to update based on the month, based on the quarter, based on the year, as opposed to using some sort of password generator. And so the prescription of passwords, password complexity, password length, actually becomes a detriment to overall security. Mm-hmm. Right? If we're really looking at it.
Yes.
And that's where the prioritization, and that's where I wish there was more ability to actually update some of those standards, at least the language around very, very specific points like passwords, mm-hmm. When it doesn't actually exist in there, right? Like,
yeah.
Especially when you start talking about governmental regulations, right?
Yes.
Absolutely. If they specify that you have to have 8 characters of passwords and that's sufficient, that's written into every policy and every state organization, and fighting against that or trying to improve it is going to be a battle that you're going to be fighting as a security director of a county somewhere for years and years, mm-hmm. because hey, why are we going above and beyond what the state and what the government has actually said is secure? I don't think there's a silver bullet there, Ken, to be, to be completely frank. It's just we're going to be fighting it. And there's every one of those items, there's going to be discussion points around it, but especially mm-hmm. authentication.
So. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we follow NIST's current best practices, which is to do away with, your password rotation requirements, because to your point, it does not make anyone more secure. And as long as you have sufficiently complex passwords connected to phishing resistant MFA and some other detective controls around potential compromise of accounts, you're gaining nothing from making users rotate their password every 90 days. But even though that's, NIST's guidance, that sometimes conflicts with other frameworks or other organizations' internal policies. So we do end up having to, have that discussion and try to figure out where we can land.
Yeah. Well, and that's it. Like NIST is a US standard, mm-hmm. right? Like mm-hmm. that's what every DOD agency, right? Like all state and local governments are supposed to follow NIST. But that recommendation, I just posted a link to it, mm-hmm. Tech Radar, that came out in November, I think, of 2024. That hasn't made its way down to your local city government, right?
Exactly.
They haven't even probably thought about it at this point, right? Like how many years is it going to take for us to get to that point? Mm-hmm. And that's only the recommendation of, hey, maybe you shouldn't encourage this constant, changing of passwords. And that's only one aspect that we're talking about there.
Exactly.
So it's an incredibly difficult problem. Yeah.
It's super obnoxious. It's my least favorite. To iterate on. Just get stuck in the weeds forever on those types of things.
Ken, I do love that your the platforms in general that offload that sort of decisioning, right? Instead of being hey, we're going to be the ones that do this, they're like, oh, you can log in via GitHub, right? Or via Google, and mm-hmm. whatever you want to do over there, your organization has already specified, they've set up those controls. So it becomes less of a, hey, I have to respond to this. Instead, it's a, hey, what single sign-on provider are you using? That's where it's being dictated, right?
And it's really nice when you are able to go through when you do from a compliance standpoint. What's also really nice about that is that when the compliance slash their internal security requirements, where they want you to use their federation, so their Okta or their whatever. If you piggyback off of, GitHub or GitLab or ADO or whatever, they've already had their systems hooked wired those systems wired up for Okta or whatever their SSO federation server is. And so it's cool. You get to piggyback off of that already existing setup. So when you get the security questionnaire, just answer it and say, yeah, like, hey, you already get that for free with your provider. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
just a little bonus thing. Yeah. That was total lucky accident for us. That wasn't like planned. It just, yeah, it was a happy accident.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. Well, I had a spicy question for Nathan though, Seth, okay. If that's okay.
Go right. For it.
This is more opinion-based. This is more opinion-based. Mm-hmm. Like, I was reading this article. I don't remember. It was some Substack, and they were saying that they posited that these days, with all of the information that's out, companies like yours, it's actually easier for new companies that launch to be new, either brand new or like, you know, we'll say small, trying to get to mid and, mm-hmm. and large size. Those businesses tend to be more, I don't know if this is true. This is what they said. That are their theory is that those companies are more secure out of the box because from the get-go, they have all this information. They know that they need to get their environment set up for compliance ahead of time. Like, you know, just more tooling, more knowledge, more resources. Whereas they say that if you're like an existing enterprise trying to, exist in the world and do, you've been around for just basically too long. You have too many assets, mm-hmm. too many properties. It's just too hard to mitigate risk the same way as smaller companies. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts on any of that, whether mm-hmm. that's about whether or not that seems true or false, or just generally speaking, like what you see at different levels of maturity with these organizations and their posture.
Yeah.
I do feel like policies and risk are to just set the, my view on this is that those are, it doesn't mean that just because you have policies, you are low risk, but I do think having those policies, like you said, kind of in the beginning, it mitigates risk you can mitigate risk quite a bit. So
yeah, absolutely. And I do think it is easier for new startups to be secure simply because compared to where we were, you know, 15, 20 years ago, it's easier to do the secure thing by default. And that means, you know, like we talked about earlier, you have your SSO provider, you have all your infrastructure in AWS, you have everything in the cloud. You don't have to worry about your on-prem hardware and patching that. So I think that it is true, but I'd say it's for a slightly different reason. Yeah, there are better tools, but the biggest reason in my experience is that new companies don't have any legacy equipment and apps that they need to worry about. And that seems to be the biggest impediment to keeping secure when you are an older and more like larger, more mature organization. You just have all this stuff that you have to keep around either for business purposes, to keep some of your customers happy. And as soon as you start having one-off infrastructure or configurations, it's easy to forget about that. It's easy for that to slip through the cracks. And that's going to be the part that's not updated. It's not kept secure. And so it's going to be exploited much more frequently.
You know, that just reminds me of Log4j.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's the exact same. Yeah. It's yes. Like, I remember everybody struggling because they're like, oh, wait. We have this thing, like it's in a dark corner. We forgot about it. Crap, I think it's running that. Oh, by the way, that's the thing that underpins like everything we do.
Exactly.
Transactions for finances or whatever.
You know, as a third party, those are the tests that I love the most, or you know, are the legacy ones that they come in. They're like, yeah, we have this old ASPX application that, you know, we still keep around because we have clients that pay us a lot of money. And so, but it hasn't been updated in 12 years. And I'm like, where do you want me to start? Right? Like SQL injection. Well, you haven't even looked at it yet. Yeah. SQL injection. Right. Like, you know, I just, yeah, because that's where we were 12 years ago, to your point, yeah. Nathan, right? Like it's usually a walk in the park for the testers when they get into those situations.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And as a newer company, you just haven't had the chance to create those dark corners, but stick around long enough, you eventually will.
You'll be
Well, and that's, you know, that's part of it too. Like if you're, you know, running a business, Ken, right? Like after 2 or 3 years, you start to think about it. You're like, wait a second, we did things different 3 or 4 years ago. And so now I have these like data repositories or these services that I used back then that I'm not keeping an eye on as closely as I was when we started. And so you can see how it happens, especially with growth, with new people coming on. I mean, I think that's where policy does help, like from a standardization perspective, a review perspective, SOC 2, like there's a reason why we have these standards and these policies, but there's always going to be that dark corner. It's going to exist in every organization at some point. So I, like, what are your recommendations then, Nathan? Like, how do you prevent something like that from happening, or how do you combat it as a large, like, organization that's been around a while?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the number one thing to combat that is you have to identify and inventory your dark corners. So that has to be the start. And you're right. Policies can help with that. You should have a policy that says that you are tracking anything that's outside of your standard configuration or architecture somewhere, like a risk register, but actually having the technical controls to make sure that's enforced is also really important, because if you know that the dark corner exists, that's half the battle, because the next time you have a log for J, you know where to look and you know what to look for versus, hey, I have no idea what's running in my tech stack. I have no idea what my external attack surface looks like. I can't even answer the question, am I vulnerable to this new 0 day? So start with the inventory and go from there. Do your best to try to get rid of it, but also, you know, understand that, like you said, somebody's paying you a bunch of money to keep something around, you're probably not going to be able to use security as the excuse to shut it down.
And so Bobby has a good comment here. The tech that is taken for granted is what hurts the most when things go bump in the night. That's where most assumptions are. Like, there's nothing else that I can say, but I can agree with that, right? Like, that's where you feel it. I don't know, I struggle with this, like what you're saying, Nathan, like with a lot of organizations, because when we walk in, they're like, hey, help us build an AppSec program. And I'm like, great. Like, what applications are you running? And they're like, our marketing website. I'm like, you guys don't make money off your marketing website, right? Like, no, what are the applications that you're running? But most of them, like most security teams are pretty blind when it comes to that actual asset inventory. Or if they have it, it's a list of IP addresses and that's about it.
Yeah, no, it's really important for the security team to understand how your business operates and how they make money. Like, that has to be like the foundational understanding of your security team.
You're absolutely right. I'd actually argue that I have a very, like, this is very personal to me. I think everybody in a smaller, I understand a certain size of company, but especially in like a startup, small company, it's like, to me, everybody should be very dialed in on what is the purpose of your business and how do I best enable that to flourish. But that's more my take on that, I guess. I was going to mention, I forgot. So there was something really interesting that you said, and I was like, oh man, I want to dig in on that. It'll come back to me, I'm sure, Seth. And getting older sucks. Memory stinks. But
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, gosh. Me neither.
Yeah. We're talking about asset inventory.
I was going to say, like, compliance. Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. It's like compliance, the value I see in it. And because, you know, everybody has different feelings on compliance and whether it's worth it, you know, worth it or whatever. But the point is, I think that I find with compliance is that it just keeps you, doing the things that you should be doing. It just keeps you disciplined. You have to tie yourself to some kind of procedure. You have to have certain things in place and you have to follow those things. Like, so for instance, it's very a good example would be, and this is, by the way, really freaking annoying. I really don't like this with new services, but I'm seeing this with like services where you want to share something you've created using that SaaS platform, and then it immediately onboards the person you just invited to that project as like a user.
Yeah.
And now when you go to do your access request reviews, you're like, wait, I don't have anything like an IT access request that maps to this new service over here. And that's just one example of like, you know, you start to then, for me anyways, we start to audit those services to find out if they have those that functionality, and we start opting out of all of that functionality. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we would have never thought to do that if we weren't required to go do an access request. And then we're like, wait, why are there people in these different services when we know we didn't actually invite them and add them? And also, by the way, we're paying a little bit more money now on our license because they just added us to, you know, they bumped us up because of the new or whatever. So, I mean, there's many ways there are many scenarios I could point to like that. But that is like, for me, the kind of the key with compliance is just keeping us disciplined, keeping us, just doing boring adult stuff. Mm-hmm. That's very, very important, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is the stuff that you have to do on a regular basis and be consistent about it. Otherwise, a gap there is totally going to bite you in the future. And again, like, everyone hates audits, but that is, or should be, the goal of the audit is to make sure that you are doing all those things. And so I've always viewed audits they can be a pain, true, but I want to find out where I'm not acting consistently so I can fix that, because we are doing all these things for a reason, or at least we should be. If there's something that adds no security value, I am the first to push back on it. But asset inventory, access reviews, those actually have value. Everyone should be doing them.
Mm-hmm. On the value, the second you get a React 2 shell or a SHA-Fluid or Log4j, you need to know immediately what's running, what kind of data is flowing through it. Is it forward facing? Is it this? Is it that? When you can dial in, you can start to say, okay, these are my riskiest three apps. Those have to be updated immediately now, or whatever it might be. So totally agree.
Yeah.
Sorry about the cough. I know it's the end, so I'm going to give that to you because you always do the little outro thing.
So Nathan, these episodes always go so quickly from our perspective, right? Especially as we start digging into the different nuances of security in general. Appreciate your time, but we are at about an hour. We want to be cognizant of the time. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for coming on. Before we close things out for today, though, is there anything that you would like to promote, or how can people actually interact with you and find you? Like, is there a spot that you're going to be, or an online service that you use?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not on a whole lot of social media, but I am on LinkedIn. So if you connect with me and mention that you heard me on this podcast, I will absolutely add you as a connection and will be happy to chat with you. I'm not an RSA person, going back to the beginning. So I'm not going to be an RSA. Vanta will be an RSA. So if you're interested, please stop by there. I'm not quite sure where my next conference is going to be, actually. I don't think I have anything scheduled, but I'll be somewhere, whether it's DEF CON or Black Hat or someplace there later this year.
Well, make sure to come. Like we always do a happy hour or an event at DEF CON.
Yeah.
And would love to have you there. Like we always we'd like to have guests and let listeners connect as well. So let us know what your plans are for DEF CON, because we'll definitely be out there.
Like, absolutely.
Based on all of the things that happen with our teams, that's pretty much a must, right, Kim? Right.
Yeah, I can't not go.
Yeah. No, yeah, exactly.
You're not traveling to anything else like smaller conferences though, right? I just want to make sure.
Not right now. That always changes last minute based on when I get asked, hey, do you want to go somewhere? So I don't have anything on my calendar right now, but yeah, who knows what will happen in a month or two.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it changes, let us know.
Absolutely.
Love to meet up in person.
Yes, would love to.
Yeah. Well, good. Again, appreciate it, Nathan. Thanks to everyone for listening and interacting today. We will be back next week. I think we have the guys from I think it's Aerith Security, right, Ken?
That are Mohan and Naveen.
Yeah. That one will be interesting as well. But feel free to reach out to Nathan if you've got questions about Vanta and what they do over there. Compliance stuff is good. Like, there, you know, you're on my list as far as when we need SOC 2, Nathan. Like, that's always been a, like, yeah, it's always a, we're waiting until we absolutely have to.
So. Yeah, good choice.
All right, good choice. All right, appreciate it. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll catch you all next week.
All right, bye.
Thank you.